What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Natalie Silverstein, author of Simple Acts, The Busy Family's Guide to Giving Back. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's Passover season now, which reminds us that the search for freedom and liberation from persecution and slavery may be in the news every day, but these are not exactly new concepts for Jews. We have a very long history indeed of experiencing both slavery and persecution, and leaving to go somewhere else where things promise to be better. When I teach Jewish history, which I often do, make the case that from the time the Second Temple was destroyed back in the year 70 until the State of Israel was founded in the year 1948, my people's past was a series of repetitive cycles of movement, acceptance, accomplishment, resentment, persecution, and finally, exile again. We were not wandering Jews by choice. We were forced from our original homeland of Israel by brutal invasion and destruction, and then forced again from subsequent homelands by anti-Semitism and persecution. We Jews know well what it's like to live without safety on a constant basis, although we can now thank God that for most of us that memory is becoming an ancestral one rather than a personal experience. But this still makes Jews particularly sensitive to the peril that immigrants and refugees live under, the terror that impels them to flee violence and exploitation and seek freedom and opportunity. It takes a great deal of fear to make someone leave the only country she or he has ever known, where the terrain, food, and culture is familiar, to abandon home and family and flee to a place where they know no one, where the language, lifestyle, and laws are all alien. There's a level of desperation and human need in this act that cannot be ignored. Of course, to state the obvious, here in America, we are all immigrants or the descendants of immigrants whose parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents or earlier antecedents came over by boat from nations where conditions were usually awful. They fled persecution, poverty, violence, starvation, and war seeking freedom. There are actually no Americans, except Native Americans, who can pretend they are not descended from refugees, asylum seekers, or immigrants who fled dire poverty. This week, we Jews gather to affirm something at our Passover Seders, Friday and Saturday nights, that all Americans can learn from. It's this. No matter how far we may have come, we proclaim loudly, "My father was a wandering Aramean," and "Our ancestors were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt." You know, most peoples spend a lot of time proclaiming that their ancestors were conquerors or kings. We remind ourselves, especially at this time of year, that we are the descendants of the poorest of the poor, the truly wretched refuse of the world, as Emma Lazarus put it, the slaves. As such, we're commanded to remember those who are not yet free, who struggle still to achieve freedom and safety for themselves and their children and grandchildren. We proclaim, "This year, not everyone is free. Next year, may we all be able to celebrate freedom." May we all remember that, not only this week, but always. It's beginning to feel a lot like Pesach these days, what with all the preparations for this coming holiday of matzah and maror, gefilte fish and such. It starts Friday night, but the most important work we need to do in these pre-Passover preparation days is to remove what is called chametz from our homes. Chametz, or chometz, is anything leavened. Bread, cake, cereal, cookies, candies, virtually anything made from grain or fermented versions of grain, including beer or whiskey. All of these are forbidden on the holiday of Passover on the grounds that we are only supposed to eat matzah and other types of unleavened bread and matzah-based products. The week before Passover begins, this week, First Seder again, Friday night, April 19th, we Jews engage in a process of removing all the leavening from our homes, searching for and eliminating chametz from our dwellings, just as our ancestors did in every age. Of course, we only eat matzah because the Israelites had no time to allow bread to rise in their haste to escape slavery in Egypt. But Jewish law extends this requirement to an exhaustive spring cleaning that removes every crumb of bread or grain residue from our homes totally. That process of bedikat chametz, searching for chametz, mechirat chametz, selling the chametz, the leaven, and finally, biur chametz, burning the chametz, that culminates at the end of this week, is a complicated observance indeed. You might say that in order to be absolutely sure you have correctly removed all the leaven from your home, you need the help of an officiating rabbi. Well, not really. The rule of thumb should be, do the best you can. Proclaim that you have tried hard, and then celebrate Pesach with the joy of freedom after the effort of preparation. To play us in this morning as part of our pre-Passover preview of music for Pesach, less than a week before the holiday begins, here's Kilo Na'eh, a hymn from the later stages of the Seder this Friday and Saturday nights, as sung by cantor Alberto Mizrahi.
Kilo Na'eh, Kilo Yoweh, Kilo Na'eh, Kilo Yoweh, Kilo Na'eh, Kilo Yoweh. Adin Biblocho, Bachur Kalocho, Zunam Yavru Loelecho, Recho, 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 Adoy Shema, Mavrocho, Kilo Na'eh, Kilo Yoweh. Kilo Na'eh, Kilo Yoweh, Kilo Na'eh, Kilo Yoweh.
That was Kilo Na'eh from the Haggadah for Passover, coming to a Seder near you Friday night and Saturday, April 19th and 20th. By the way, our inaugural congregation Beit Simcha's first night Seder is fully subscribed now, 100 guests, kind of amazing, about which we are very excited indeed. Our guest this morning is the energetic and delightful Natalie Silverstein, author of Simple Acts, The Busy Family's Guide to Giving Back. She'll explain just how we can model and teach generosity and tzedakah to our children no matter what else is going on in our lives. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Natalie Silverstein has written a new book, Simple Acts, The Busy Family's Guide to Giving Back. A really interesting and I think helpful workbook on how to help your family do tzedakah, really. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell me about the motivation for creating this. I know you're the volunteer coordinator of Doing Good Together. That sounds like a great organization by its very name, but tell us a little bit about how this came about.
Sure. So I have three children. The oldest actually turned 18 on February 20th, and my son is 15 and my little one is 11. And when they were born and in, you know, the early years of parenting, I was really kind of struggling with finding volunteer opportunities, service opportunities in New York City that would welcome families with young children. And I was sort of struck by this. I couldn't believe that, you know, in a city of 8 or 9 million people with a lot of need, a lot of organizations that help others, that nobody would welcome me and my kids. You know, I wasn't suggesting that I would send my children off to do service alone. We wanted to do this as a family. And I had a lot of trouble finding opportunities, meaningful opportunities for us to do service together, which was something I thought was really important. I thought that that was a way to live our values, to teach my kids empathy and compassion and to understand the needs of the world around them. And so I was sort of casting around for a listing or a listserv or a way to search for opportunities. I couldn't find one. I wanted to create one potentially. That seemed like a lot of work. I didn't want to create a website on my own. And I stumbled upon Doing Good Together, which is a national nonprofit based in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And it was started about 15 years ago now, I guess, by a woman named Jenny Friedman. And she was doing just really wonderful work. It's a fantastic website. I would recommend that your listeners check it out. It's doinggoodtogether.org. And it has just tremendous resources, lists of books that you can use to spark a conversation with your kids, printable items that you can use, ways that you can get involved together, conversation starters, those types of things. And I noticed that she had a listing for the Minneapolis area that she curated of family-friendly opportunities. And so I reached out to her and I said, you know, I'd love to kind of franchise what you're doing in New York City because I live here and I think that this is something we could really use. And it was one of those, like, kind of Besharet moments where she wrote back to me within 5 minutes and she was like, I cannot believe you just reached out to me. I've been wanting to become national and take my concept and spread it around to other cities. And I can't believe this happened. And it's such perfect timing. And so we worked together to sort of teach me how to do this in New York City. So this is now about 5.5 years ago. So I curate a listing of family-friendly volunteer opportunities in the community here, mostly in Manhattan, although it should encompass the five boroughs, and I try and include as much as I can for the other boroughs and Long Island as well. And then I funnel that information to Doing Good Together, and they package it up and they send it out in the same format as they do in Minneapolis. Since I started, of course, we have been able to go to even more communities. So Baltimore and Boston and Silicon Valley. And so our hope is to grow that even more. And I'm a volunteer for them. I do this just because I love it and I'm passionate about it. And so that work really started to open up new opportunities for me to interact with other families, with other parents who care about this just as much as I do and who are passionate about doing service with their kids. And I started getting asked to go and speak to school groups, brownie troops, faith organizations, certainly churches and synagogues. I've been asked to help with service days and mitzvah days. So it's become this sort of job. And I've become kind of an area expert in service opportunities for kids and families. I say in the book, you know, I don't think a week goes by when I don't get an email or a text from a friend saying, gee, you know, my kid really loves animals. Like, where can we volunteer together? Or my son's bar mitzvah's coming up, and do you have any ideas? He really loves to read. Is there something with books that he can do for his mitzvah project? And so it just I don't know, it gave me great joy. I love doing it. I love sharing this with people. I love providing these ideas to folks and then seeing it come to fruition for their families and engaging them. And then the idea for the book just kind of grew out of all that.
We'll talk more about the content of the book and how you and your family or families you know can get more involved in doing righteous acts, doing the right things that help communities when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, festivals, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant community striving every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Our magnificent Beit Simcha home, 3001 East Skyline Boulevards, on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell for Shabbat services at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday morning Torah study at 9 a.m. with services at 10 a.m. every week. Our inaugural first night Passover Seder is this Friday, April 19th at 6 p.m. Fantastic experience of the Feast of Freedom in song, story, food, and celebration. Shabbat Passover morning services are Saturday at 9 a.m. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great Hebrew school, religious school, Torah Tikes program, teen program, and rich array of adult education academy courses, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's www.BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest growing congregation in Tucson at its exciting beginning stages. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as a very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, it's election season in other countries, and in Ukraine, which we've spoken about not too long ago on the show, a crazy election in which a Jewish candidate who's a comedian who's never held political office but plays the president on TV has won the first round of their election campaign.
By a handy margin.
Yeah, like almost doubling the current president's total. But there's another round to come.
Right. So a lot of European countries have a system whereby in the first round of elections, there's a whole bunch of candidates. And the top two move on to a second round that's a runoff between those two. Ukraine is among those countries. And the top scorer was this Ukrainian version of Jerry Seinfeld.
Right.
Now, you know, a couple of comments. One,
well, can you imagine a TV star being elected president? How could that be?
Right. Good question. So, I mean, the last time we talked about Ukraine, one of the things we mentioned was that the Jewish population of Ukraine is much bigger than the official figures. I think the official figures are like 200,000. But people in Kyiv alone say that if you define Jews broadly, like somebody with a Jewish parent or a couple of Jewish grandparents or Jewish background, whatever, if you use a broad definition of who's a Jew, that Kyiv alone has 600,000 Jews.
Wow.
So the numbers are huge. And even though anti-Semitism is alive and well in Ukraine, and some would say you imbibe it with your mother's milk, the numbers of Jews alone, plus younger people who are more liberal and entertained by this Seinfeld-like character, will overlook their inherited anti-Semitism and vote for a Jewish candidate. The other thing is that the other two leaders in the first round, who combined got less of a score than
Zelensky, the Jewish
Zelensky, whatever comedian. His name is. Yeah. The next two combined got fewer votes than he did, and that's in part because they are established politicians with a record of corruption, nepotism, et cetera, et cetera.
All so, the things that always happen in Ukrainian politics.
Probably. Well, except this guy so far is clean because all he's been is a stand-up comedian.
Right, and a TV star.
And, I mean, the other thing that's interesting, and I think I've mentioned this before also on your show, is that everywhere in the former Soviet Union, if you wanted to succeed as a comic, whether you were Jewish or not, you had to fake an Odessa Jewish accent because that was seen as funny. It was sort of the Jack Benny accent for people of our generation who might actually remember who Jack Benny was. You know, it was a certain type of accent that predisposed people to laugh. And even non-Jews who wanted to succeed at stand-up comedy, even far away from Ukraine, far away from Odessa, if they were somewhere in the former Soviet Union, they would take on that accent. So this guy, I'm sure, is quite adept at that.
Fascinating. Boy, and you can't make this stuff up. You just can't. Thanks, Tom. And the final election is next week, and I guess we'll talk after that.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. With Passover just a week away, the Jewish community in Madrid found itself in a desperate situation. There was an acute shortage of horseradish, the key condiment, fiery and delicious, for gefilte fish, also known as chrein. A cry arose and the whole community was mobilized in an effort to prevent this terrible tragedy. All the European Union countries gave the same reply, "Sorry, we have no horseradish to send." In desperation, the Madrid rabbi phoned a yeshiva friend in Israel and begged him to send a crate of horseradish by air freight to Madrid. 2 days before Passover, a crate of grade A, tear-jerking Israeli horseradish was loaded at Ben-Gurion Airport onto an El Al flight to Madrid, and all seemed to be well. Unfortunately, when the Madrid rabbi went to the airport to claim the horseradish, the baggage handlers had gone on strike. No shipments could be unloaded for at least a week. He was unable to get more than a token box of chrein, not nearly enough horseradish for all the Spanish Jews. You guessed it. As a result, the chrein in Spain stayed mainly on the plane. Maybe it's better if you sing it. The chrein in Spain stayed mainly on the plane. Maybe not. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and enjoy the chrein on your gefilte fish at the Seder. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our young representatives of Israel, Ron Benakot and Rotem Rappaport. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
And Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Almost, almost. So Seder's coming up Friday night, the first night of Pesach. One Seder for you guys, did you have two or did you have more than one in Israel when you were living there?
I remember having two, but I'm kind of blacked out right now.
I think we had one at the beginning and one at the end.
Right.
Uh-huh. I don't think we had like a day after day one.
Right,
not, but it's
not
the same.
Not
it's not the same. It's kind of different.
The second one's kind of different. So tell us your favorite. You love Pesach.
I love it. Yes.
So tell us why.
Because ever since I'm like five or six, I wake up every Passover, kind of like a few days before Leila Seder, and I make matzahs with my grandpa. We come and there's like a bunch of people and we make sure the water and the flour are not like mixing in
right.
And like under 18 seconds.
18 minutes.
18 minutes.
18 seconds would be very quick.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, it was, but, yeah, I remember it's not that.
Right.
And we have to do everything really fast. And then these are the matzahs that we eat in Leila Seder. And it's really cool.
So you make your own matzot. What kind of an oven? Is it a...
It's like a big stone oven.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So like a big rock stone oven.
Yeah.
To make matzah. That's a great memory. Yeah. Were the matzahs good?
I don't really like matzahs, so like...
I don't like matzah either, I have to tell you. How about you, Rotem?
So I have a big memory from Pesach that my aunt had this giant house. I can't like describe how big it was. It used to be a Scottish hospital once.
Oh, wow.
So it was like... enormous. Yeah. Like, it had a lot of gardens and a lot of buildings. It wasn't a house. It was like a mansion, like something huge.
Nice.
And looking for
You'll give me her number so I can go stay there when I visit.
She doesn't live there anymore. So. But she moved like a year or two ago. But finding the Afikoman there was a big challenge.
Oh, the Afikoman. When you hide the Afikoman in a place that large.
Yes. And we were like... We're a giant family as well. My mom has 8 brothers and sisters. And
oh, my goodness.
All the cousins and the
second
children
cousins
of the cousins. Yeah. So we would have
cousins.
This big competition about the Afikoman. It lasted for hours. People were looking all around the house. It was like enormous.
Awesome. Who hid it? Was your aunt the one who hid the Afikoman?
My aunt's husband sometimes.
Right.
Yeah. And each mother had the gift for her children so nobody will feel left out.
So everybody got a prize. Yeah. That's how I like it. But you got to make the kids work very hard before
yes.
you give up.
Yeah. Yes.
The finding the Afikoman is a big part of everything. Listen, I hope you have a wonderful Chag Sameach v'Kasher, or even not Kasher for you, Rotem, but...
Oops.
Uh-oh, the secret's out. Have a wonderful Pesach, a great holiday for you. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
And now a word of Torah. The readings on Passover are some of the most dramatic and interesting of the whole Torah reading year. We remember the Exodus from Egypt in a variety of ways, in prose, poetry, recalling the sacrifices of our ancestors through rituals that we still observe. We use Torah during Passover in the same way we use the Haggadah at the Seder, to teach and remind and refresh our understanding of the great blessing and value of freedom and liberty in every possible permutation. Freedom is too easy to take for granted. We must always remind ourselves of its blessings. We do so by celebrating freedom in word and song. May we always enjoy the liberty to do so in this society and in every society. And may others who are not yet free become free soon. On this last Sunday before Pesach, and in tribute to the bread of very little flavor, here's the wonderful poet Marge Piercy, a multi-past guest of Too Jewish, and her positive spin on matzah. Flat you are as a doormat and as homely. No crust, no glaze, you lack a cosmetic glow. You break with a snap. You're dry as a twig split from an oak in midwinter. Bumpy as a mud basin in a drought, square as a slab of pavement. You have no inside to hide raisins or seeds. You are pale as the full moon pocked with craters. What we see is what we get. Honest, plain, dry, shining with nostalgia, as if baked with light instead of heat. The bread of flight and haste in the mouth you promise home. That was the wonderful poem Matzah by Marge Piercy for Pesach, which begins Friday night. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Natalie Silverstein, will explain just how a family that's too busy to take on one more thing can actually benefit tremendously by choosing to embrace giving tzedakah together. Find out how that works when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our
Israel made news on earth and in the heavens last week with a national election for prime minister and the first attempted unmanned moon landing by a nation not named America, Russia, or China. But first, the politics here on earth. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu was the victor in the Israeli national election last week. Netanyahu's Likud party won 35 seats in Knesset, Israel's 120-seat unicameral legislature, while the blue-white Kahol Lavan party of Benny Gantz also won 35 seats, but with the Orthodox parties aligning with Likud and other smaller right-wing parties already agreeing to support Netanyahu, it appears he will easily be able to assemble a coalition of about 65 seats, five more than necessary to form the next government. When Netanyahu does announce that government, he has an excellent chance of becoming the longest-serving prime minister in Israeli history, passing founding premier David Ben-Gurion this coming summer. This Israeli election was close and hard-fought, but ultimately tipped Netanyahu's way in spite of his three separate indictments for corruption. As we hear on Two Jewish predicted before the elections, Netanyahu was likely to win. Bibi Netanyahu is a political magician. He has managed to outfox his opposition and outmaneuver everyone in Israeli politics for a decade. This election between Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu was close throughout, but it may have turned when President Trump declared the U.S. accepted Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights. That annexation, by the way, took place in 1981, some 37 years ago, but Trump decided to approve it in March. Netanyahu's late pledge to also annex the West Bank settlements may have brought out a few more hard-right voters in the late going, but it seems unlikely that he will actually fulfill that promise. What do the election results signify? Essentially, more of the same from the Israeli government and very little likelihood of any peace process with the Palestinians making much progress. Of course, I believe that if Israelis really had faith that there was any chance that such a peace process would make progress, most of them would embrace it. But the average Israeli doesn't believe the current Palestinian leadership in Gaza, certainly, where terror-loving Hamas reigns but is holding off even more radical rivals like Islamic Jihad, or in the West Bank, where the aging and corrupt Fatah remains in control. The Israelis don't believe that they have any real ability to lead the population towards a peace agreement with Israel. And after Netanyahu's latest election and seeming permanent place at the top of Israeli politics, both sides can credibly claim that there is no partner for peace to be found.
Shine on, Harvey Bloom. Up in the sky, you have been in orbit since January, February, June, and July. Don't come back too soon. We rented out your room. So shine on, Harvey Bloom, up there on the moon. We'll miss you on the holidays. This year they're coming later. We hope you have a very lovely Seder in your crater. Your mama sent the astronauts some chicken soup at school. They're using it instead of rocket fuel.
On a much more elevated plane, Israel tried to land an unmanned space vehicle on the moon last week, culmination of the almost decade-long space IL journey. Its chief scientist was a guest here on Two Jewish last winter. For tiny Israel, population about 8.5 million, to have developed, coordinated, and successfully launched and tried to land a lunar module on the surface of Luna itself is remarkable. Only the U.S., Russia, and China have ever landed a vehicle on the moon before, and of course only the U.S. has ever landed human beings there. When we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the first Apollo moon landing this summer, we will now need to note Israel's incredible attempt too, but sadly. There was a malfunction as the lunar landing module approached the moon. An engine failed or went offline somehow. By the time they got it back online, it was too late. The descent was well in progress and much too fast. Turned out to be a disappointing, moon-shaking event for Israel, where most of the population was glued to screens watching the Bereshit probe try to land last Thursday. As Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Or As poet Robert Browning put it, man's reach must exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? What indeed? Hopefully they'll be back. In more down-to-earth news, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio declared a public health emergency last week over a measles outbreak in Brooklyn's Haredi ultra-Orthodox community. De Blasio ordered unvaccinated people living in four zip codes in the Williamsburg neighborhood to get the vaccine or be required to pay fines of up to $1,000 each. There have been 285 reported cases of measles in Brooklyn's Orthodox Jewish community just since October, including 246 children. In the whole U.S., only 465 cases have been reported so far this year. The areas covered by this order are where most of the city's measles cases come from. They are largely populated by Haredi Jews. This is the epicenter of a measles outbreak that is very, very troubling and must be dealt with immediately, de Blasio said. The measles vaccine works. It's safe. It is effective. It is time-tested. The faster everyone heeds the order, the faster we'll lift it. We cannot allow this dangerous disease to make a comeback here in New York City. We have to stop it now. This order comes one day after the New York City Department of Health threatened to fine and even close yeshivas in Williamsburg if students are not vaccinated against measles and allowed to attend classes. Last week, a New York State judge lifted the state of temporary emergency imposed by Rockland County that would have barred minors not vaccinated against the measles from all public places. The Brooklyn outbreak has been tied to an unvaccinated child who contracted the disease during a trip to Israel. The Haredi ultra-Orthodox resistance to vaccination is odd, weird, dangerous, especially given their love of children and the Jewish legal obligation to protect lives. It seems to be based on a belief that preservatives used in the vaccines may contain non-kosher elements in them. Several Haredi children who were not vaccinated have died from measles recently. In happier news, the largest Seder in the world has typically been the one conducted in Kathmandu, Nepal, filled primarily with Israeli backpackers and post-army travelers. But this year, the resort area of Koh Samui in Thailand will likely eclipse Kathmandu and have about 2,800 attendees at its Chabad-run Seder. You know, I attended one such distant Seder 4 years ago in Cuzco, Peru. It had about 800 people attending, also mostly Israelis traveling the world after their army service. It was really fun, if a little industrial in quality, as probably is necessary. Still a remarkable way to celebrate the Festival of Freedom abroad. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Natalie Silverstein has written a remarkable book, Simple Acts, The Busy Family's Guide to Giving Back. By the way, it's very accessible. It's not a hard read. It's got a lot of stuff that jumps off the page at you. She's a volunteer coordinator of Doing Good Together, as she described in New York City. And let's talk a little bit about the complication. I also have three kids. We really first started addressing this issue mostly because of my oldest son's mitzvah project long ago, and realized that although we did a lot of tzedakah, or, you know, we had tzedakah, some kind of charitable stuff, and kids were supposed to do that, and we participated in doing various things, there wasn't any system to what we did, and it could get pushed out of the way very easily because three kids with all their extracurricular activities, plus school, plus Hebrew school, plus bar mitzvah, blah, 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 really difficult. Tell us a little bit about how you address that and how the book structures its work.
Absolutely. So I think that's really why I wrote the book, because it really was sparked by a conversation I had with a friend at an event, and I was saying that I was doing some project with one of my kids, and they said, oh, wow, I just don't know how you find the time. You know, I wish I could do more of this with my sons. And I said, well, you know, if you just do one thing a month. And she was like, one thing a month? How can you possibly find the time? And I thought to myself, you know, with all due respect, and she's a lovely woman and she really has good intention, but we find time for so much other stuff in our kids' lives. You know, you've mentioned they are absolutely scheduled and overscheduled to some extent, right? The practices, the musical instruments, the sports, the tutoring, the you name it. We managed to prioritize all of those other things. I firmly believe, and I'm sure that you share this belief, that prioritizing service, prioritizing empathy and compassion and doing good in the world and teaching kids that they can make a difference in the world is just as important, if not more important. And yet we don't necessarily prioritize it. And so I talk in the book a lot about how, you know, saying yes to this may mean saying no to something else, and that that's okay. And that by doing so, you are living your values and you're modeling for your children that this is important, that this is really important. This is maybe the most important thing. And so, I do think when I talk to Jewish audiences, you know, I talk a lot about how now, you know, not starting this process when a kid is approaching Bar Bat Mitzvah, that really it should start so much sooner where they can cultivate their interests and the different types of service opportunities that they want to engage in when they're younger. And then it can really come to fruition when they become a Bar Bat Mitzvah, can really take on a much more meaningful role in their lives and then hopefully continue on beyond Bar Bat Mitzvah age. You know, my son's project was an amazing, he's 15 now, it was a wonderful organization started by kids for other children to bring birthday parties to children in homeless shelters and domestic violence shelters. And so it's a Kids for Kids organization, so all of the volunteers are children, and he started doing it for his mitzvah project, and he continues to do it today. And one location, a certain domestic violence shelter here up in Upper Manhattan, is his location, and he does 3 parties a year, and he knows how to run it, and he has such pride in this work, and he recruits other teens to do the work with him. And it really, it makes a huge difference. This is what we want our kids to be doing. But I think the way that the book approaches this, and the reason why I wrote the book, is to say that there are things that you are already doing in your day-to-day lives that you can incorporate service and acts of kindness into. And so there's a whole chapter on birthday parties, for example. There's a chapter on other milestones that your children may hit. You know, the first steps, first lost tooth, first day of school, all of these ways that you can take something that's already happening in your life, a joyful event, an important event, and say to yourself, be open to the possibility that you can share that with other people. How to incorporate service and acts of kindness into your travel plans when you have everyone goes on vacation with their kids, whether they fly off somewhere exotic or they're just going in the car. What can you be doing to incorporate service in small ways, small but meaningful ways? And that's really the point, too, is you don't have to change the world, right? You don't have to go and fly off to Africa and build a school. Little things make a ripple effect, and they are like drops in the bucket of the kind of emerging character of your children. And they come to learn that this is not this big deal thing that we have to do and congratulate ourselves. This is just the way that we go about doing business in our family, because this is what we value.
You know, when people say they're too busy, I always wonder, isn't it always a choice?
Of course. Of course. What's the expression? I quote an author who says, if you say that something is not your priority, sorry, if you say you don't have time for something, change those words to, it's not a priority for me,
right,
and see how that feels.
Yeah.
Now, no one would ever say, doing good in the world and teaching my children to be good people is not a priority for me. Everyone would say that it is. But when you say I don't have time for service, that's kind of what you're saying. So I think that that's, you know, look at your calendar, look at your busy, busy schedule and say to yourself, what is our priority as a family? Where can we find the time?
I admit I felt guilt as I read this book.
Oh, geez.
I was thinking, like, all of the birthday parties that I put on or helped put on for each of my kids,
right,
and all the decorations and the stuff and the cakes,
right,
and felt like hundreds anyway. There's only 3 of them, and they're not
like
that old, but it does after a while, you know.
Well,
and you go to all
you
these.
Count them up. I counted at this point, and I still have a young child. I've made something like 40 odd birthday parties.
Yeah.
Right? It's crazy.
And then of course for your spouse, and then you think like, well, wait a minute, I didn't put tzedakah. I didn't make. I'm using the word tzedakah in the broadest sense. I didn't come up with some form of service, some connection to the community.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really give back at any of those.
And that's okay. Listen, I also say, you know, there's a whole chapter on birthday parties because that is a really fun, meaningful way that our family has found to incorporate service. And again, not every single birthday party, but certainly we've tried to over the years. And here's a way, and in the milestones chapter as well, and in the family traditions chapter, here's a way of taking something that is joyful and meaningful, and you're creating a family memory, and adding a layer of gratitude to it and saying, we are so blessed and happy to welcome a new baby to our family, for example. What can we do to show our other children, to show our greater our larger family, our extended family, our greater community, that not only are we rejoicing for ourselves, but we're going to share this with someone who is in need or with the rest of the world. So, you know, planting a tree in Israel, if you will, asking for donations in lieu of gifts, you know, using decorations on the tables instead of just using flowers, which are unfortunately going to be thrown in the garbage, or if you do use flowers, to donate them to a nursing home after the event, but instead having books on having children's books, piles of children's books as the decoration, and then donating those to a local charity, and telling folks that that's what you're doing, and saying this is how we're sharing our joyful event with those who perhaps, you know, need help in our community.
It seems to me that the awareness that you create, and you do it in the book by also talking about the calendar and how you can connect every event to something related to service, or you know, trips, all of the different ways that we just kind of making it a part of your own regular productive life. In other words, it's not just, okay, once a year we go bring food to the homeless shelter, or on December 24th, since we're Jewish, we go take over for our neighbors and proctor at a women's shelter, whatever it is. I think the idea is to make it integrated into every part of your life.
Right, exactly. And that it's not a big deal thing. It's not a big patting ourselves on the back thing. It is just the way that our family goes about the world. And every tiny, and I hope this comes across in the book, they don't have to be huge, grand gestures. They don't have to take hours and hours of your time. Every time you hold the door for another individual, you use the name of the person who's checking you out at the store, you let your child put a few coins in the tip jar. You know, every tiny little act of kindness, every act of service, you are modeling for your children this type of behavior. It's just like a drop in the bucket of their developing character. And I'm just a big believer in that. I don't think it has to be these big showy, you know, mitzvah days are wonderful, and our temple does an incredible day in the fall. It's a whole weekend, in fact, and hundreds of congregants participate, and we're always a part of it, and it's amazing. It doesn't have to be that. That's very labor-intensive, and sometimes the message is kind of lost in all of the running around, you know.
Right, all the logistics.
The logistics, exactly. Right. The little things that you can do on a snow day. We happen to have a snow day here as we're chatting today. you know, on a snow day, when kids can be, instead of watching television or whatever, and after they've finished their homework and other things, you know, if another child comes over to play, baking cookies and delivering them to a sick neighbor or an elderly neighbor. We happen to have a nursing home, an assisted living facility right next door to us here in Manhattan. I have my kids make cards, and we'd go and deliver them, you know, for Valentine's or something. These are just small little things. It's not a huge deal. It's just a kind of seamless part of the way that we live our day-to-day lives. And I hope that that's the message that comes across in the book.
I think it does. So I have a trickier question. You know, at one point I was living with three teenagers at the same time. They tend to be slightly skeptical about everything. Do you ever get pushback on, oh, Mom, do we got to do that now?
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't necessarily get a lot of pushback from my kids, and I think that's because it has been so much a part of our lives for such a long time that this is just kind of what we do. But also I think that it's not always going to be successful. Listen, I hope I also share in some of my personal anecdotes that, you know, sometimes things get messed up, and sometimes kids get bored, and sometimes they don't behave the right way, or the whole activity falls apart because people are unpredictable, and the recipient of what we're doing can be unpredictable. It's okay. You kind of need to roll with the punches, kind of
keep a sense of humor about it, keep an open heart, you know, be positive that this is still a good thing that we're trying to do. You know, I think also with teenagers, you really need to give them some agency in this. I think they start to have really strong opinions about the issues that matter to them, you know, and so I think allowing kids to see an injustice in the world or hear about something or read about something, see something on the news, you know, if they are empathic people, the way that you've raised them to be, they will see it and want to do something. And so you let them kind of guide how your family is going to approach that problem. As long as you are, as a family, having these conversations and saying, okay, what is important to us? And maybe one kid says, well, it's important to me to help the animals. Okay, well, maybe that's not so important to another child. What's important to you? And then trying to figure out ways that you can address those things in a meaningful way, I think that you've won the battle there, because then they will automatically be a little bit more engaged because this was something that they cared about.
I feel like we could talk about this subject a great deal more, but we're running short on time. Tell us, where can people go to find out more, both about Simple Acts, the Busy Family's Guide to Giving Back, and about the work that you do?
Sure. Well, doinggoodtogether.org is an amazing resource for families who are interested in learning more about doing service with their children. It just has tremendous, tremendous ideas and book lists and conversation starters and just wonderful things. So I encourage everyone to check out Doing Good Together, and you will see Doing Good Together mentioned and referenced throughout my book. Obviously, the Griffin House website is a great place to go to just see my book and learn a little bit more about me and the book. It's available wherever books are sold.
Which in this world is mostly Amazon, but that's okay.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble, and I have friends who are ordering it from their local booksellers, which I love as well. And I do have a Facebook page that I've launched, and I'm trying to use not only to promote the book, but also to promote some ideas from it. So that's just Simple Acts Guide.
I want to thank Natalie Silverstein for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Again, the name of the book is Simple Acts, The Busy Family's Guide to Giving Back. I think it would make a great book for people working on bar mitzvah projects, but also anybody raising kids. Griffin House, GryphonHouse.com is the website. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Tal Kinan, an IDF pilot, entrepreneur, fund manager, philanthropist, and now the author of God is in the Crowd, 21st Century Judaism. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website, top 10 Jewish podcast in America. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Passover musical preview for Pesach, the festival coming up this Friday night, April 19th. If you have your reservation already, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha for a great first night Seder, our very first as a synagogue that first night of Passover. Our playout comes from Yehoram Gaon, the Sephardic version of Echad Mi Yodea en Ladino, Who Knows One. My friends, may you have a Chag Pesach Sameach V'Kasher, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Quien supiense y entendiense alabar al Dio creense, cuálo es el uno, cuálo es el uno. Uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense alabar al Dio creense, cuáles son los dos, cuáles son los dos. Dos Moshe y Aaron, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense alabar al Dios creyense, cuáles son los tres,
igualos son los tres. Tres nuestros padres son dos, Moshe y Aarón. Uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dios criense. ¿Cuáles son los cuatro? ¿Cuáles son los cuatro? Cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón. Uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.